This is Kathy coming to you with the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, the 22nd of July. Looking at the first page, local government, Decatur. Long-distance bus passengers who once rode Greyhound out of Decatur now have a new choice. They can get their flicks on Route 66 and a whole lot of other places. The Decatur City Council signed off on a service agreement Monday with the Flix Bus Incorporated Company, allowing them to use the Senator Sevens Transit Center bus station downtown as an intercity bus stop. Service is expected to begin in August, the precise date yet to be decided. Flix bus vehicles are typically painted in a bright green logo, but they are in fact closely related to the blue and gray Greyhound lines incorporated. Both are now owned by the same German-based parent company, Flix SE. And while Greyhound handles long cross-country journeys, Flix has a focus on regional city-to-city travel. A briefing memo to council members from City Manager Melissa Hahn said the city's new Flix service will include Decatur on a route between Chicago and St. Louis. Service will run twice daily, 6 days a week, with potential to expand a 7-day service, Hahn said. Stop times would be 12:45 p.m. and 7:55 p.m. Decatur will be served on the Chicago-St. Louis corridor, with connections available through both cities throughout the United States. Councilman Pat McDaniel welcomed the arrival of the bus service, but wasn't so happy about the arrival times in his city. "That's not really good hours," he said. "If somebody wants to catch a train or whatever, those really aren't good hours." A check of corporate records shows that FlixBus took over Greyhound, which used to operate in Decatur, in 2021 for a cash deal valued at $172 million. FlixBus had been running in the United States since 2018, but roping in Greyhound gave it access to proven coast-to-coast network, covering more than 2,000 destinations and already moving some 16 million passengers a year. The two bus lines now operate an integrated service, allowing passengers to book tickets for both lines in one seamless operation through FlixBus.com. Establishing intercity bus service will improve regional and national connectivity for Decatur residents, students, visitors, and workers by providing affordable access to employment, education, healthcare, and other destinations, Hahn told the City Council. Improved transportation options also strengthen Decatur's competitiveness by expanding access to labor markets, customers, and investment opportunities. Public support for the arrival of FlixBus came from Molly Berry, Vice President of Admission and Student Affairs at Millikan University. She told council members the bus service would get an A grade from potential students looking at her school to pursue their degrees. "What students are saying and families are saying is, we would love to commit to Millikan in central Illinois, but how do I get my student here? We don't own a car," she said. So FlixBus would address this need and would also create a barrier-free environment for students to commit to central Illinois and thus commit to our community. Councilman David Horn, who teaches biology at Millikan in his day job, said the new bus service and Decatur's needs made for a symbiotic relationship. "Decatur is a city with greater than 65,000 people, and so to have intercity bus service return to the city of Decatur after many, many years is a very exciting development." One final note of caution was raised by Councilman Dennis Cooper, who asked whether other cities with Flix bus service had seen any increase in crime. "Since the buses coming from Chicago and coming from St. Louis, have they had any experience of having any upped issues regarding security as far as gang activity or guns coming in on those buses from those locations?" he asked Lacey Elzey, the city's Director of Economic and Community Development. Elzey said she had reached out to places that already had Flix bus service, like Champaign and Bloomington, and to the company itself, and asked if there had been any issues or complaints, and they have not had any, she told Cooper. And that article was written by Tony Reed. And also on the front page are several pictures of what we're living with recently. It's called In the Haze, and you can just see, looking out over the tops of the downtown buildings, looking from Johns Hill Park. There was an air pollution action day on Monday, and it's just hazy. It's just foggy. And then there's another one on East Decatur Street, appears hazy during an area-wide air pollution action day from the Canadian wildfires in Decatur on Monday, July 20th. Health. Study looks at the safety of coffee. "Here's how much coffee it's safe to drink every day," research says. Good news for coffee lovers, mostly. In a review of the latest research, the American Heart Association found multiple cups of your morning brew won't have negative health impacts on your heart, but how you drink it matters. In a new scientific statement published on July 20th in the Association's peer-reviewed scientific journal Circulation, researchers found that most adults can safely consume up to 5 cups of coffee per day, which is about 400 milligrams of caffeine, without increasing risk of cardiovascular disease. These findings are based on black coffee, since large amounts of added sugar, flavored syrups, and dairy products can substantially increase caloric intake and counteract potential health benefits associated with the coffee itself, the authors note. The 5-cup rule does not apply to higher doses of caffeine, however. High doses of caffeine, such as those found in energy drinks, including energy shots, may have harmful effects on the heart and should be avoided, said Dr. Gregory Marcus, a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, and the Associate Chief of Cardiology for Research at the University of California, San Francisco Health, in a news release. Marcus is also the chair of the AHA Scientific Statement volunteer writing group that released the findings. These harmful effects may include increased risk of high blood pressure or irregular heart rhythm or arrhythmia, according to the research. Energy drink shots can contain 3 to 4 times more caffeine than regular caffeinated coffee per fluid ounce. Consuming caffeinated coffee without added sugars, flavors, or cream, on the other hand, was linked to a lower risk of type 2 diabetes, heart disease, stroke, heart failure, and some irregular heart rhythms, the research found. The review also explored research on coffee's impact on cholesterol, finding unfiltered coffee such as espresso, French press, Turkish coffee, or boiled coffee contains a component that is associated with higher levels of bad cholesterol. The authors note that while coffee is the main source of caffeine for most adults, keep in mind that tea, soda, and chocolate can also contribute to overall caffeine intake. More research is still needed on how caffeine from different sources affects different people, the authors added. Although research suggests that caffeine consumption may be associated with certain cardiovascular benefits for some people, it's important to remember that there is no one-size-fits-all strategy for safe caffeine consumption, Marcus said. People can respond very differently to caffeine based on various factors such as age, medications, underlying health conditions, genetics, and how quickly their bodies metabolize it. And why your morning coffee is getting expensive. The sticker shock starts in the coffee aisle. A bag of beans that cost $16 a few years ago now pushes past $20. A latte that once felt routine has become an occasional splurge. Behind those higher prices is a crop that has become one of the world's clearest indicators of climate change. From Brazil to Guatemala, coffee farmers are navigating increasingly erratic weather, while labor shortages, shipping costs, and trade uncertainty add new pressures throughout the supply chain. Coffee prices jumped more than 18% over the past year, according to the latest Consumer Price Index report, making it one of the steepest increases among grocery staples. That puts it alongside beef prices, which has climbed as herd sizes shrink and supplies tighten. But the similarities mostly end there. Where beef reflects a slow squeeze on supply, coffee is reacting to something more immediate. It's not just this thing of global warming, said Max Odin, green coffee buyer for Nashville-based 8th & Roast. It's that, but it's also instability. Inside 8th & Roast's production space, staff gather around a long table for a daily cupping, tasting dozens of coffees side by side in a standardized process designed to catch even slight variations before they reach a customer. Here, consistency matters even if the conditions behind it are constantly shifting, and a slightly off aroma is enough to pull a whole batch. But that careful control applies only after the coffee is harvested. Behind those beans is a story that stretches from farms in Central and South America through shipping routes, commodity markets, and roasteries before ever reaching a cup. Coffee is a delicate crop, and even small shifts in temperature or rainfall can ripple through yield and flavor. In some regions, warming temperatures have pushed coffee cultivation higher into the mountains, into places where it couldn't survive even a few decades ago. Places that were previously thought to be too high to grow coffee can now grow coffee because the climate has warmed up, Odin said. But the weather's unpredictability may be the bigger issue. Odin recalls one longtime producing partner in Guatemala whose farm swung from the worst harvest in its history 1 year to the best the next. problem wasn't simply a drought or a rain, it was the swing between them. Farmers can adapt to known challenges. Planting becomes harder when conditions shift wildly from season to season. A late rain can arrive at exactly the wrong moment, washing out a crop just as the cherries near ripeness. Other years bring opposite problems. Without enough rain, the fruit dries out and shrivels on the branch. What worries growers isn't just bad years, but how quickly conditions flip between extremes. The cadence is increasing, Odin said. It's absolutely more volatile. That volatility marks a shift for an industry that was once more predictable. For the most part, it's been a steady price, said Edward Reed, owner of 8th and Roast. You'll see spikes around big events, but nothing like what we saw last year. Those swings don't stay on the farm, but move outward through the entire coffee economy. Brazil, the world's largest coffee producer, holds enormous influence over prices. Even the threat of a late frost can ripple through the global market almost immediately as traders anticipate tighter supply. Earlier this year, Arabica futures climbed to record highs and amid that uncertainty. Those prices have since pulled back as traders anticipate a large harvest in Brazil this year. Climate, though, is only part of the story. Coffee harvesting is also highly labor-intensive, with cherries typically picked by hand and only within a narrow window of ripeness, making farms especially vulnerable to labor shortages if workers don't arrive on time. Migration patterns and border policies can determine whether crops get picked at the right moment. During one harvest, restrictions along the Costa Rica-Panama border kept workers from reaching farms in time. Coffee just sat there and rotted off the trees, Odin said. From there, costs continue to build. Shipping has become more expensive. Packaging, fuel, and equipment have all increased in price. Earlier this year, proposed tariffs added another layer of uncertainty, forcing buyers to recalculate what their coffee might cost. A 50% tariff can quickly change the math, Ogden said. Coffee that maybe was $3 a pound green to us overnight. That's a huge increase. The solution isn't as simple as following the math, he said. You can't just immediately say, by the way, it's 50% more expensive today. Most companies absorb what they can, adjust gradually, and hope the market steadies before the next disruption arrives. At Nashville's Elegy Coffee, owner Brian Rushton said the pressures for cafe owners extend well beyond beans. A box of cups before COVID was $68, Rushton said. By 2022, we were like at $148. Labor costs have climbed, utilities are higher, and even small increases in everyday supplies add up, he said. It's kind of across the board, Rushton said. Literally, everything has gone up. For customers, those changes often show up in small, steady increases, a dollar here, a few dollars there, until the total starts to feel noticeable. But like many operators, Rushton said the goal is to avoid passing every increase directly onto customers. We're eating part of it, he said. We're doing our best to stay within market and not gouge. For coffee shops and roasters, rising prices bring another challenge, explaining those increases to customers who see the menu price but not everything behind it. At 8th and Roast, the conversation often starts with sourcing. One of the company's coffees, Sweet Brazil, was the top-selling coffee in Kroger's Middle Tennessee region last year, outselling national brands, Reed said. Internally, the team jokes that part of its success is the name. We were the number one selling coffee in that Kroger region in Middle Tennessee last year, even against the national stuff. Dunkin', Starbucks, you name it, Reed said. For specialty roasters like 8th and Roast, buying coffee isn't just about price. Many build long-term relationships with farmers returning year after year and working through both strong harvests and difficult ones, which can provide more stability when the crops fail or the market spike. Odin argued that approach goes beyond certifications. Even fair trade standards, he said, don't always guarantee a living wage. Their fair trade minimum price was not a living wage, he said. For Odin, the conversation isn't really about whether coffee should cost more. The question is, who absorbs the cost when the harvests fail, weather shifts, and markets grow unstable? For him, the answer comes down to how those relationships are built. It's not fair trade, he said. It's a fair shake. City announces grant winners among concerns and doubts by Tony Reed. Eight organizations were judged deserving enough to share in a $70,000 taxpayer-funded Decatur giveaway called the City Council Community Grant Program. They had better make the most of it, however, as there were serious doubts raised at Monday evening's council meeting on whether the grant program will be back for a repeat performance. The names of the winners read out by City Manager Melissa Hahn were Decatur Family YMCA 5000, God's Place of Deliverance Church 6500, Boys and Girls Club of Decatur 8500, Good Samaritan Inn 10000, Decatur Area Arts Council 10000, Children's Museum of Illinois 10000, Macon Resources Incorporated 10000, and United Way of Decatur and Mid-Illinois 10000. Hahn told council members that the original plan was to carve up the $70,000 taxpayer cash set aside for the grants into seven allotments of $10,000 each. And while the program anticipated awards of up to $10,000 each, two applicants requested less than the maximum award amount, she explained. As a result, the remaining available funding was awarded to the next highest scoring applicant, allowing a total of eight organizations to receive grant awards. Award winners had to get through a scoring screening system first, washed through the city's professional staff, and then finally judged by council members themselves. All that is, except for Councilwoman Lisa Gregory, who said she hadn't taken part and wanted nothing to do with it. Gregory said the grant program was the wrong thing to do in the wake of a city budget that refused to raise taxes and told city department heads to cut their spending. Yet tonight we are discussing grants that, while small in context to the full budget, represent taxpayer dollars, dollars that taxpayers expect to be used for core city services and infrastructure, not discretionary giveaways, said Gregory, who read from a prepared statement. Every tax dollar steered toward a grant is $1 pulled away from roads, policing, clean water, or other essential city functions. Our job is to safeguard Decatur's long-term financial health. Councilman Pat McDaniel backed her up. I couldn't say it better, he said. I totally agree that the city should not be involved in this. The council had originally signed off on creating the grant program in March, but it hadn't enjoyed an easy berth. Mayor Julie Wolf Moore had worried that splashing other people's money on grants may not be prudent at this time when the city was facing possible state-mandated clawbacks in funding. Her proposal to delay launching the program had been defeated 4-3 at the City Council's March 2nd meeting, and then a vote to kill the grant funding altogether was also shot down by the same 4-3 margin. Speaking at Monday's meeting, the mayor acknowledged applications for help had been received from worthy and deserving organizations, and, as they had gone through the process, she would vote to approve the grants this time. The agenda item to finally pay out the money was approved by a 5-2 vote on Monday. But I agree with Councilwoman Gregory's remarks because, really, this is not our lane, Moore Wolf said, explaining the city must stick to its core job of funding public safety, clean water, and critical infrastructure. I think we need to stay in our lane, and if this renewal for another grant program comes up, I will not support it. The majority voting in favor Monday with a reluctant mayor included David Horn, Ed Culp, Dennis Cooper, and Consuelo Cruz. Horn said the city of Decatur oversees a general fund of approximately $100 million and can afford to spare a little cash to keep charities and not-for-profits doing vital work afloat in a time of need. Many organizations in this city are facing increased demand for services and rising costs to provide them, Horn added. Simultaneously, revenue to provide these services is not keeping pace with demands and costs. This has resulted in multiple entities making emergency appeals to the community for support, and some entities closing their doors temporarily or permanently. And so do we, the City Council, have the ability to fund programs or partially fund programs that are helping the most in need? Absolutely. Councilman Cooper said the grants went through a rigorous review process, and while those receiving them this year should not be eligible to receive them again next year, the grant system should continue to give others a chance to apply. So I'm hoping that we will continue that next year, and if at all possible, hopefully be expanded from just $70,000, he said. I am very supportive of these grants and approving these grants. Decatur seeks to accommodate more hotel tax revenue by Tony Reed. The Decatur City Council voted Monday to be a lot less accommodating about how it collects its 8% hotel use tax on short-term private rentals booked online through portals like Airbnb and VRBO. Instead of previously relying on rental property owners to choose to pay, council members followed the recommendations of City Manager Melissa Hahn and voted unanimously to amend the city code to demand that the online hosting sites remit hotel use tax directly to the city for those properties not licensed, registered, and/or paying the hotel use tax for the short-term rentals. Hahn said the city knows of 40 or so registered properties playing by the rules, but isn't sure if others are flying under the hotel tax radar. This will help us, we believe, to get a better understanding if there are other properties that are not registered, she added, so we can reach out to those folks and then assist them with any remittance of that local tax if they are not already doing it. And the city's assistance with remittances can get very insistent. Fines for anyone caught skipping the city's tax on their rental space or not paying the city's annual license fee for such short-term rental properties, which is $25, can range from $250 up to a maximum of $500 for each offense. And a penalty levied at a 10% per 30-day period is imposed while any tax bill remains unpaid. Councilman David Horn said it was about time the city got serious about collecting what it was owed. He pointed out that the council voted 3 years ago to change the law to require property owners turning their homes into mini hotels to pay that $25 license fee and start collecting the 8% tax. What are the barriers that the city had to overcome over these past 3 years to get from the city council passing an ordinance to creating this mechanism for collecting the hotel motel tax, he asked Hond. The city manager said as she wasn't in charge then, she couldn't answer that question. She also said it may be well that the city hasn't been missing out and that the 40 or so properties it knows about that pay taxes are all that is. But she also said requiring the online booking portals to funnel the tax money gives that other tool to use to make sure everybody is registered and playing by the rules. Mayor Julie Moore Wolf pointed out, and Hahn agreed, that trying to track properties in the city limits working as short-stay hotels isn't easy. Hahn said searching the online sites for places to stay in the Decatur area, for example, also throws up listings in Mount Zion, Forsyth, and even Blue Mound. No actual address is pinned down until the booking is made. Horn then asked if the city had a sense for how much money it collects annually on the approximate 40 locations that are licensed. Hahn said she did not, as the proceeds are rolled in with the total receipts from the hotel motel tax. But I can get that and share it with the council, she added. The city's tax fees are only one of the extra costs visitors to Decatur have to pay, however. The state of Illinois imposes its own hotel operators' occupation tax, known as HOOT, on spaces being used as hotels. State law says online room booking platforms like VRBO and Airbnb must collect and remit the 5.64% tax if they handle $100,000 or more in business over a period of 12 months. So guests checking into Decatur should see a total levy state and city taxes of 13.64% on their bills. But that's cheap compared to Chicago. The Windy City's package of hotel taxes combined with the state tax rate adds up to a hefty 19% or more, making the total tax charge one of the most expensive in the nation. And things might be destined to get more costly yet under House Bill 5776, which is currently stalled in the House Rules Committee, but might check in for a new lease of life in the fall veto session. Filed in May by Representative Will Guzzardi, a Democrat of Chicago, the bill would enact the Short-Term Rental Excise Tax Act, tacking an extra statewide 4% surcharge on all bookings under 30 days made via online booking sites. Guzzardi said the cash windfall would be used by the Illinois Housing Development Authority to build, staff, and maintain permanently affordable housing programs. Polling places change for some Macon County voters. The Macon County Clerk is sending out notices to voters whose polling places have changed. New ID cards sent to these voters will include the new polling place, and voters are urged to carefully review their voter ID card to confirm their polling location prior to the election. For election updates and information, you can visit MaconCountyIllinois.gov or call the Macon County Clerk at 217-424-1309 or email elections@macon.illinois.gov. This headline is, what has made the cyclospora behind the U.S. outbreak so challenging to trace? Cyclospora, the parasite behind thousands of suspected U.S. cases of foodborne illness, has a long incubation period, and samples cannot be cultured in labs, making it especially challenging to trace. To investigate, laboratory scientists have worked with epidemiologists to gather information from infected patients about what they ate, where, and when, and then the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has tried to identify the tainted food products. From those interviews, public health officials have traced a large outbreak in Michigan, Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia to shredded iceberg lettuce from Taco Bell restaurants supplied by Taylor Farms operations in Mexico. The officials often must rely on those interviews instead of testing because of the particular characteristics of Cyclospora. The FDA did test Taylor Farms product at the U.S.-Mexico border, aimed at preventing more tainted produce from entering the United States. That initially produced a positive result for the presence of Cyclospora, but it turned out to be a false positive following quality control checks, the agency said. Still, its investigation and the outbreak data continue to point to shredded lettuce from a Taylor Farms location in central Mexico, the agency said in a briefing on Monday, and the company has issued a recall of all iceberg lettuce products sourced from that region of Mexico. Even so, Taco Bell accounts for only about 60% of all cases in the multi-state outbreak, according to former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb. Investigations of other possibly unrelated outbreaks are still underway, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Cyclosporiasis is very hard to test for. There's no whole genome sequencing, Gottlieb said. FDA relies on whole genome sequencing to effectively fingerprint a pathogen to try to isolate a particular pathogen to a particular outbreak to a particular grower. You don't have that in this case. Some better-known foodborne pathogens, such as Salmonella or E. coli, cause symptoms within a few days of consumption, but Cyclosporiasis symptoms can take up to 2 weeks to appear, too long for people to easily recall what they ate and where. By that time, fresh produce items, such as tainted lettuce, may already be out of stores or restaurants. The tiny parasite that causes cyclosporiasis cannot be traced using the most advanced testing methods in which scientists grow pathogens in their labs and sequence the full genome of the organism. This produces a genetic fingerprint that can be matched with contaminated food sources. Because this is a parasite and not a bacterium, cyclospora cannot be grown or cultivated in labs, a process that increases the amount of genetic material used to confirm its presence. Instead, scientists have to extract the genetic material from the organism and make synthetic copies of its DNA, a process that can sometimes result in false positive results, as it did with the FDA's testing. It's extremely difficult to detect in food, even with the highly sensitive methods that we use, Donald Prater, the FDA's acting deputy commissioner for food, told the briefing. Last week, the CDC urged doctors to consider testing for Cyclospora, which would ensure more people get the proper treatment with a course of antibiotics. But it could also cause unintended consequences. Craig Hedberg, a University of Minnesota food safety expert, said because of the harvest cycle and the perishability of fresh produce, the contaminated lettuce that infected so many people in the Midwest likely already has moved through the distribution system. But because the publicity generated this outbreak, Hedberg said, many more people are likely to seek out testing. We'll probably see a huge influx of new cases, and it doesn't necessarily reflect that the actual outbreak, has continued to grow. The Red Kettle Classic golf outing is set for August 7th by Valerie Wells. The Salvation Army's Red Kettle Classic golf outing will be Friday, August 7th at the Red Tail Run Golf Course. Lunch, provided by Notorious PIG, will be served at 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. with a shotgun start at 1 p.m. The awards reception will follow the golf. A cash bar will be available throughout the day. Registration is $100 per golfer and includes range access, lunch, 18 holes of golf, and the reception. Participants may register individually or as part of a four-person team, and a VIP card option will be available for $50, offering additional on-course activities. Businesses and community members are invited to support the event through a variety of sponsorship events. To register, contact Jeff Daly at jeffdaly@usc.salvationarmy.org. Or you can call 217-428-4672. And that's the end of part one of the Decatur Herald in Review. I will be back in a couple of minutes with part two.